Last week we started talking about the next generation, the generation after Abraham, and we looked at Ishmael, his first son, and what happened to Ishmael. We looked at Isaac, his second son, and the child of the covenant, the son of the covenant, the son through whom all the promises that God had made to Abraham would follow through, all the blessed to be a blessing promises. And through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed, would come through his son Isaac. Next week we'll start looking at the next generation after that, after Isaac. But today we're going to talk some more about Isaac and look at a little bit more of this child of the covenant, the second generation. We saw in chapter 22 the test that God gave Abraham of asking him to sacrifice his future. He had already asked him back in Genesis 12 to sacrifice his past. In Genesis 22, he asked him to sacrifice his future for the sake of God, the future being all those promises and blessings that God had promised to go through his descendants through Isaac, and God commanded Abraham to sacrifice that. And he did, and he was going through with that, and God stopped him, and God protected Isaac, protected his promises. So going on, we see in chapter 23 is where we'll start today. And this takes place when Isaac's about 37 years old. Okay, now Abraham and Sarah are fairly old at this time because they had Isaac in their old age. So starting out in chapter 23, verse 1 to 2, Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She then died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. So when Isaac was 37 years old, his mother, who was 127 years old at the time, died. Now, Abraham was still around. Abraham had lost his lifelong partner. He and Sarah had been together forever. In fact, they were brother and sister to different mothers, but same father. They had been husband and wife forever, trying to have kids forever. We've talked about that. So now Abram has lost his lifetime partner, but it also presented another problem for Abraham. We see in the next verses 3 to 4, Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. He said, "I'm an alien and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so I can bury my dead." Remember, Abraham didn't own any property. He was a wanderer. All this land that God told him to leave your land, leave your family, leave your people, and go to the land I'm going to show you, and he took him to Canaan. And all the time that Abraham was there, he never owned any property. He was just wandering from place to place. We see that he went down to Egypt during a time of famine. He went to the land of the Philistines during a time of famine. Most of the time, he was around the Negev, the southern part of Israel, down in the dry land, in the land of Canaan. The Hittites were a big, powerful group of people that lived in this area on up into Turkey. The Egyptians had trouble with the Hittites. We don't hear about them anymore because they were pretty well wiped out. We'll see as we go on. But the Hittites were there then, and Abraham didn't have a place to bury Sarah. So he said, "Sell me some property. Okay, so that I can have a place to bury Sarah." So how did the Hittites respond? Verse 5, the Hittites replied to Abraham, "Sir, listen to us. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead." So it's like, "Oh, God, Abraham, we'll give it to you. You name it. Any place you want to bury your wife, it's yours. Well, no problem." Did Abraham have a site in mind? Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. He said to them, "If you're willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so that he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him, and it's at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you." So there's a cave, and caves were often used as burial sites, and so he wanted to buy this cave so that he could then bury Sarah, and it could be his family tomb for Abraham. Okay, so he wanted this cave. It belonged to this guy named Ephron, who was a Hittite. How did Ephron respond to this request? Verse 10, Ephron the Hittite was sitting among the people. Now, at this time, they were at the gate of the city. That's where, if you wanted to conduct business, if you wanted to meet important people, if you wanted to talk to a city official, talk to a judge, they all gathered at the gate of the city so that people who were in the city could come out to the gate, people who were out in the fields would come to the gate. You see this, people of importance would sit at the gate. Job, we see. If you look at the story of Job, he sat at the gate, and that tells us he was one of the leaders. You see Lot, when the angels came to Sodom, Lot was sitting at the gate as one of the leaders of the city. Okay? So Ephron was sitting there along with all the people. This is where they Abraham had come to the people. So this was important and official to him. Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. He said, "Oh, my Lord, listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that's in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead." Okay? So he has no problem with giving that cave to Abraham. He said, "Look, I not only give you the cave, but I'll give you the whole field that goes with it." Now, there's a reason that he would do that. If he just gave him the cave was part of the field, and Ephron would retain responsibility for taking care of that property and paying taxes and those kind of things. However, whoever owned the field, that's who was responsible. So if he gave the whole field over, then he would not be responsible for any of the property, and all that would be those liabilities would go with Abram. But still, he's talking about giving a field. He's offering to give the cave. He's saying, "Hey, look, you're an important man. I give it to you. It's yours." Okay. How did Abraham respond to this generous offer? Verses 12 to 13. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, "Listen to me, if you will. I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so I can bury my dead there." So he didn't want the gift. He wanted the cave, but he wanted to pay full price for it. Okay, he wasn't asking for it as a gift. Why not? Well, we see the same sort of thing. If you remember back in chapter 14, this is after he had rescued Lot and the other people of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other towns around there who had been conquered by the kings of the north and east. In chapter 14, verse 21, 22, the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and you keep the goods for yourself." Okay, because whoever was the victor in a war was entitled to all the spoils, which included all the anything of value, including the people who could be used as slaves. And it was a big thing of King of Sodom just asking for, "Hey, give me the people, let them have their freedom." But Abram's response, he said to the king of Sodom, "I've raised my hands to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will not accept anything belonging to you, not even a thread or the thong of a sandal, so that you'll never be able to say, I made Abram rich." So why did he not accept the gift from the king of the spoils of the war and turned over to King of Sodom? Why did he not accept the gift of the cave from Ephron? Because he recognized that all of his blessings come from God, that his wealth, if he tries to, he wasn't looking for someone else to make him rich, he's looking for God. And God had promised to bless him greatly, and God had blessed him greatly, and so he was limiting his income to gifts from God, not from men. All right? Well, Ephron was wanting to give this to him, so did Ephron accept Abram's money? Verses 14 to 16. Ephron answered Abraham, "Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver, but what's that between you and me? It's yours. Just bury your dead." Okay, so again, he's trying to give it to him. Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. So Abram said, I want to pay the full price for it. He really only wanted the cave, but Ephron was going to turn over the field with it as well. Ephron didn't want to keep the field and turn over the cave. So he said, "It's worth 400 shekels. Well, is that a lot? Is that a little?" Well, take a look at, if you look at Jeremiah 32, verse 9, you see that a field there in Jeremiah 32, verse 9, sold for 17 shekels. If you look at Genesis 37, 28, you'll see that when they sold Joseph, Joseph's brother sold him to the Ishmaelites into slavery, they sold him for 20 shekels. So 400 shekels sounds to be an exorbitant amount of money. And so Ephron's kind of taking advantage of the situation here. But Abram can afford it, and Abram doesn't care. Abram just wants to bury his wife in a place of honor, and so he pays that over. So does Ephron deed over the entire field or just the cave? We see that in the next verses. Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field, was deeded to Abraham as his property in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Afterward, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is called Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. So we see now Abraham owns some land. He owns some land purely not because of trying to gain the land or buy the land or own the land, because that land would come to him, would come to his descendants as a gift later from God. God had already made that clear. But he purchased this land so that he would have a burial site. And we'll see, this becomes the family burial site, the family cemetery. We'll see future generations, even when Jacob dies in Egypt. Joseph brings Jacob back to the site and buries him here. Okay, so that's chapter 23 and the story of Sarah dying and Abram finding a burial property for her. Okay, so now that his wife is dead, that kind of makes Abram think of a few things. What does it make him think about? What does it prompt him to take care of? He thinks about his own mortality. Heck, he's 10 years older than his wife. She is 127. He's 137. How many more years does he have? He doesn't know. So what business do I need to take care of before I pass on? And so what does he decide he needs to do? Chapter 24. Abraham was now old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. He said to the chief servant in his household, the one in charge of all that he had, he said, put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, by Yahweh, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from among the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living. But you will go to my country and to my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac. Okay, so that's one thing that he's concerned about. His son's 37 years old, which is old for those days, and is not married. Okay. Why is that a problem? Well, because of all the promises that God had made to Abram, again, are going to come through Isaac and through his descendants. Through Isaac, Isaac isn't even married, much less starting to have kids. So Abram needs to get that going. However, remember, they're called to be, back in Genesis 17, Abram and his descendants are called to be a separate, cut off, a circumcised people. Cut off and not intermingle and intermix and intermarry with the people that live around them. So he makes sure that it's clear. Heck, I could die tomorrow, so I want to make sure that it's clear before I die that my chief servant knows and everybody knows that Isaac is not to marry one of these Canaanite or Hittite or one of these other women around here. He's to marry within the family, okay, because we are a separate cut off people. And so he has his chief servant, who is his chief servant? Well, if you look back at Genesis 15, verse 2, he talks about how before he had any kids, that Eliezer of Damascus, who was his chief servant at the time, would be his heir. This could still be Eliezer. A number of years have passed. Maybe Eliezer is no longer around and it would be someone else. It doesn't tell us, but it could possibly be Eliezer. And he says, put your hand under my thigh. Now, this raises a lot of comments and questions from people. You know, what does that mean? I mean, how often do you ask someone to put their hand under your thigh to make a promise? This appears to be as unique back then as it is today. We'll see it again one more time in another story, but the word thigh could be is used in a number of different ways. It's used for the word thigh. It's used for the word a shaft or a pole, you know, out there. It's used for the word for loins. And so the thought is that he's putting his hand under the upper part of his thigh, which is the place where descendants come from. And that this is an oath that is important for his descendancy, and that's why he asked him to put his hand there. And so that's where he swears the oath. Okay? All right, so he tells the servant to do that. What concerns does the servant have? Well, the servant asked him, well, what if the woman is unwilling to come back with me to this land? Shall I then take your son back to the country that you came from? So what if I go and I find a woman from the family and I ask her to come and she doesn't come? Should I get Isaac and he can go convince her? Verse 6, Abram says, make sure that you do not take my son back there. Okay? So he's got the concern, what if she doesn't come? Should Isaac go? And Abram says, no way. No way. Why not? Well, you can get a picture of that in what is in Abram's mind back, if you look back at chapter 15, and if you look at verse 13, this is when God makes the blood covenant with Abraham that we talked about. And in verse 13 it says, then the Lord said to him, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country that's not their own, and they'll be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. And then in verse 18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, to your descendants I will give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river of the Euphrates. So all that Abram knows right now about the future, and God's told him quite a bit, his descendants are going to be slaves for 400 years in another land, and then I'm going to bring him back to this land that I'm going to give to him. Okay? Well, as long as Isaac stays here in this land, then he's not going to become a slave in some other land. So let's make sure that my son stays in this land. Abram doesn't know when this is going to happen. He doesn't know if it's going to happen the next generation, third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation. He doesn't know what other land. He doesn't know it's Egypt. He doesn't know that it's not Mesopotamia. So he wants Isaac to stay right here in this land so that, at least this doesn't happen right away. So he's kind of trying to take a little control of the situation. Well, but it's important that Isaac marry someone from the family. So what about the servant's concern? What if the woman doesn't come? You know, if he's not able to bring Isaac back, then what does he do? Verses 7 to 8. Abram says, Yahweh, the God of heaven, who brought me out of my father's household and my native land, and who spoke to me and promised me on oath, saying, to your offspring I will give this land. Well, he will send his angel before you so that you can get a wife for my son from there. If the woman is unwilling to come back with you, then you will be released from this oath of mine. Only do not take my son back there. Abram knew that God's promises rested on descendants coming through Isaac, and that Isaac was to be faithful to the covenant of separation. So, although there was a lot of potential risk here, Abram didn't see it because Abram knew that God was in control. This was all part of God's plan. God would prepare the woman to be able to come, and so that she would come. But if she didn't, then God's got some other plans. And who's Abram and who's his servant to try to control what God's plan might be? So he would be released from the oath, and whatever God had in store would happen. Okay, so here you see Abram trusting God to take care of this. How did Abram make sure that this would be done even if he died first? Verse 9, so the servant put his hand under the thigh of his master Abraham and swore an oath to him concerning this matter. So he made his chief servant swear to make sure that this would happen even if Abram wasn't going to be around much longer. Okay? So, the servant takes off then. Okay, this is his charge to go do this. And how far does he have to go? Well, the servant took 10 of his master's camels and left, taking with him all kinds of good things from his master. He set out for Aram Naharaim and made his way to the town of Nahor. So he went from Hebron, which is where they were staying at the time, remember from back in chapter 23, Hebron, and went to Haran. Remember, Haran is where Nahor is, where Abram came from and left his brother Nahor, right? And that is in Aram. You've heard of the Arameans, with their language of Aramaic. That whole region up there in Mesopotamia is called Aram. Mesopotamia, if you remember, is a Greek word that means between the two rivers. Well, that's what Naharaim means. Nahar means stream or river, and Naharaim means rivers. So it's Aram of the rivers is what that's saying there. Later on, we'll see when Jacob goes there, he goes to Padan Aram, and Padan just means the valley, so the valley of Aram, same place. So he goes back to Mesopotamia. How far is that? It's about 500 miles, which, when you're walking with camels, it's about a month's journey. So quite a trip, quite a journey. What's his job when he gets there? His job is to find Isaac's wife. Well, he's got to go meet the girls. He's got to go find this wife. Where do you go to pick up girls? Well, in those days, it's not the same as today. Well, actually, you go to the drinking hole, right? That's where you go today, is where a lot of people go. That's what you did back then, is you go to the drinking hole, you go to the watering hole, you go to the well. Because the men would be out working in the field. The men had men's jobs to do. The women's jobs were to fetch the water and take care of things in the house. And fetching the water meant going to the town well. And so that's where he went, is he went to the town well to meet the local girls. Verse 11, he had the camels kneel down near the well outside the town. It was towards the evening, the time that women go out to draw water. Okay, so he got there right at the right time, and he knows where to go, and he goes. Now, we see this in other places. He's not the only one who used that as a pickup place. We see later in Genesis 29, 1-2 and verse 9, that Jacob went to that same well, and that's where he met his future wife, Rachel. Okay, we see later in Exodus 2 that that's where Moses met his future wife, Zipporah, is at the well, the town well. So we see that pickup place a few different times. Well, how's he going to know who the girl is? Who's the right girl? What does he do as soon as he arrives at the well here? Verse 12, then he prayed. Okay. Now this guy, he was the chief servant of Abraham. Abraham being one of the most faithful people who've ever lived, someone who lived in a very close relationship with God. That rubs off. When you live with faithful people, that strengthens your faith. And when you are a faithful person, you can impact other people's faith as well. And so we'll see in this story the faith of the servant that he picked up from his master Abraham. Well, then he prayed, Yahweh, O Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, give me success today and show kindness to my master Abraham. See, I'm standing beside this spring and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a girl, please let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink, and I'll water your camels too. Or let her be the one that you've chosen for your servant Isaac. By this, I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. Okay? So he's looking for God's hand in this. And so he asked God to give him a sign of, let this happen, and if this happens, let that be the one that you've chosen. I don't know anybody here. And so he prays to God for that. Okay? Well, how long did it take for God to respond to this servant's prayer? Verse 15, before he had finished praying, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder. She was the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, who was the wife of Abram's brother Nahor. So, how long did it take God? No time. He wasn't even finished praying and Rebekah shows up. So God had everything in play. God's in control here. And she shows up before he's done. He finishes praying, he looks up, and this girl's already going to draw water. Now, it says here a little bit about it. She's the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, who was the wife of Abram's brother Nahor. So if you remember, Abraham had two brothers, Haran, who died, and Nahor, who he left in Mesopotamia. Nahor married his niece, which was Haran's daughter, named Milcah. Okay, a little keeping it in the family. And Milcah and Nahor had a son, Bethuel. And Bethuel had some kids, one of which was Rebekah. So the relationship here is Abram's nephew was Bethuel, Abram's nephew's daughter was Rebekah. Abram's son was Isaac, so Isaac's cousin was Bethuel, so Rebekah would have been the daughter of Isaac's cousin. Got it? Okay, so why the shifted generation there? Well, because Abraham and Sarah took so long to have Isaac in their old age. Okay, and you see some of that in Genesis 11, recount some of the family tree there. Okay, so what, if we remember, what were some of the requirements that Abraham had given for his son's wife? Back in verse 4, he had said, "Go to my country and to my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac." Okay, so the requirement is back to my country and from my father's family, my own relatives. So that's what she is. But what else did God throw in? There's some bonuses here. Verse 16, "The girl was very beautiful, a virgin. No man had ever lain with her. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up again." Okay? So she was single. She wasn't married. She is beautiful. She is gorgeous. As you go on and you look at the story, you'll see that she's energetic. She's very kind, very hospitable, industrious, decisive. Okay? Just a all-around gold star prospective bride for Isaac. Okay, well, how much did the servant coax Rebekah to complete this sign from God? Because there's stuff that she has to do if she's, and he looks and goes, oh, you know, she could be, this is a gorgeous, gorgeous girl. I hope she's the one. So how much does she coax her here? Verse 17, "The servant hurried to meet her and said, 'Please give me a little water from your jar.' So she had gone down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up again. She was carrying her jar on her shoulder. And the servant went and said, 'Please give me a little water from your jar.' 'Drink, my lord,' she said. And she quickly lowered the jar to her hands and gave him a drink. After she gave him a drink, she said, 'Hey, I'll draw water for your camels too, until they finish drinking.' So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough, ran back to the well to draw more water," so you see her running here, "and drew enough for all of his camels," back and forth, till the camels, and camels can drink a lot of water. "Without saying a word, the man watched her closely to learn whether or not the Lord had made his journey successful." So what did he do to coax her? Nothing. He left this in God's hands. God, if this was God's plan, God would show that to him. And he did. Okay? So what did he do when it appeared that Rebekah might be the one? Verse 22. "When the camels had finished drinking, the man took out a gold nose ring weighing a becca and two gold bracelets weighing 10 shekels. Okay, so he gave her some expensive gold jewelry. What was the final proof that Rebekah was the one that God had sent? You know, at this time, you know, we see back in verse 15 who she was, but he didn't know this yet. So far, she's gone through the motions and done what he said, but he doesn't know her from Adam. He doesn't know that she is part of the family. So the final proof, verses 23-25. "Then he asked, 'Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room?" Yeah, because that's kind of a forward kind of question. He says, "Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" So he kind of puts it in that position. She answered him, "I'm the daughter of Bethuel, the son that Milcah bore to Nahor." And she added, "Oh, we've got plenty of straw and fodder as well as room for you to spend the night." She didn't know him from anyone, but you see how hospitable she is. But she goes on and says that she's part of Abraham's family without knowing that the servant knows this, and even though she probably may not even know who Abraham was. How did this servant respond to this proof? Then the man bowed down and worshiped the Lord. Okay, you see his faithfulness again. He said, "Praise be to Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness to my master. As for me, Yahweh has led me on the journey to this house of my master's relatives." So he praises God and thanks God for this success, that God did answer his prayer, did lead him to the woman who would be Isaac's wife, okay, and all the bonuses that go with that. All right, going on, verse 28, we see that the girl ran. You know, when she saw what had happened and she got this jewelry, what does she do? Well, she takes off running and tells her mother's household about these things. Okay, leaving the servant and his camels there. Well, they don't know where to go. So he goes. She goes and tells her household, tells her family. Going on. Now Rebecca had a brother named Laban. We're going to hear a lot about Laban in a few weeks. We'll see a little bit of him right here. And he hurried out to the man at the spring. Okay. So she ran home, and then Laban went. Why? Well, really, the next verse. As soon as he had seen the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, and had heard Rebecca tell what the man had said to her, he went out to the man and found him standing by the camels near the spring. So, you see, he likes what he sees. He says, "Come, you who are blessed by Yahweh, why are you standing out here? I've prepared the house and a place for the camels." So he sees the goods that this man gave to Rebecca, and he'd kind of like a little bit for himself. We see this as just a first glimpse into Laban's character traits, which we'll see a whole lot more in a few weeks. In chapters 29 and 31, you see some things that Laban is the father of, you remember, Leah and Rachel. Rachel becomes is the woman that Jacob wants to marry, and he works 7 years to earn her. That was the price put upon her head by Laban. After those 7 years of work, they get married. Then Jacob finds out that Laban had done a switcheroo and had given him Leah instead, and so he had to work another 7 years for Rachel. So you see Laban's trickery there. Don't feel bad for Jacob. We'll talk about him later too. Genesis 31:19, we see that he kept household gods, had other gods. You know, here we see him in this last verse, he recognized and identified and mentioned Yahweh and saw this servant as a servant of Yahweh, but he worshiped other gods, we see. In 31, verse 43, and then also 29, we see that he claimed ownership of Jacob and all the stuff that Jacob had earned over the years and his wives and kids and all of that. Laban claimed ownership even though he didn't own them. And we'll see that more, but you get this picture of who Laban is, and you're starting to see a little glimpse of him already. Well, very hospitable, both Rebecca and Laban. So how does the servant respond to this lavish hospitality? Verse 32, 33. So the man went to the house, and the camels were unloaded. Straw and fodder were brought for the camels, and water for him and his men to wash their feet. Then food was set before him. He's taken this hospitality. But then he says, I won't eat until I've told you what I have to say. Well, that's, in this culture, that's downright rude, okay? You do not, if you're a guest, you do not reject your host's food and raise issues before casual meal talk. There's a protocol, and there's a way that you do things, and you eat together, and you build a relationship through casual meal talk before you raise any kind of issues. But he said, I've got something I got to deal with before we start dealing with this meal. Okay, well, so it was bad manners, but he was anxious to fulfill his calling and refused to eat first because this was his purpose. So did the servant say that he would force Rebecca to return with him? Because she's obviously the one; she's the one that God's chosen. Let's see, 34 to 41. So he said, "Well, let's see." He said, "I won't eat until I've told you what I have to say." Laban said, "Well, then tell us." So he said, I am Abraham's servant. The Yahweh has blessed my master abundantly, and he has become wealthy. He's given him sheep and cattle, silver and gold, men servants and maid servants, and camels and donkeys. My master's wife, Sarah, has borne him a son in her old age, and he's given him everything he owns. My master made me swear an oath and said, you must not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I live, but instead go to my father's family and to my own clan and get a wife for my son. Then I asked my master, well, what if the woman won't come back with me? He replied, Yahweh, before whom I have walked, will send his angel with you and make your journey a success so that you can get a wife for my son from my own clan and from my father's family. Then, when you go to my clan, you will be released from the oath. Even if they refuse to give her to you, you will be released from my oath. Okay, so he tells him what his mission was, but he's not going to force Rebecca to go with him because it's in God's hands. He put the matter in God's hands. He's done his part. His oath was complete because he's made the journey. He found the person, and now it's in God's hands to have Rebecca go with him. Okay, God will provide. He's trusting God. Got in this. She wouldn't be forced to go. So what's the underlying message here? 42 to 48. Well, when I came to the spring today, he goes on with the story. I said, Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, if you will, please grant success to the journey on which I have come. See, I'm standing beside this spring. If a maiden comes out to draw water, and I say to her, please let me drink a little water from your jar, and if she says to me, drink, and I'll draw water for your camels too, well, let her be the one that Yahweh has chosen for my master's son. Well, before I finished praying in my heart, Rebecca came out with her jar on her shoulder. She went down to the spring, drew water, and I said to her, please give me a drink. Well, she quickly lowered her jar from her shoulder and said, drink, and I'll water your camels too. So I drank, and she watered the camels also. I asked her, whose daughter are you? She said, the daughter of Bethuel, son of Nahor, whom Milcah bore to him. Well, then I put the ring in her nose and the bracelets on her arm, and I bowed down and worshiped the Lord. I praised the Lord, Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, who has led me on the right road to get the granddaughter of my master's brother for his son. So the underlying message is, hey, this is all God's doing. God led me to you because you are the one. Rebecca is the one that he has selected for my master's son to marry, for Isaac to marry. Okay, God's provided this. God has selected Rebecca for this. Well, what did Bethuel and Laban think about this after they heard this story? Did they recognize this message? 49. Now, if you'll show kindness and faithfulness to my master, tell me. And if not, tell me, so that I can know which way to turn. Because again, he's not going to force her. He's leaving it in God's hand. So if you say yes, great. If you say no, okay, God's got other plans, and I'll go anyway. Laban and Bethuel answered, well, this is from Yahweh. We can't say anything to you one way or the other. Look, here's Rebecca. Take her. Go. Let her become the wife of your master's son, as Yahweh has directed. So they recognize that this is from God. How does the servant respond? Same way he's already responded a couple times we've seen. When Abram's servant heard what they said, he bowed down to the ground before Yahweh. So you see his same reactions that Abraham has when God showers him with blessings as he thanks God and praises God and worships God. And you see that he did that here too. Okay? Now, again, Rebecca's been chosen to be the wife, to be the bride of Isaac. The way things were done in those times in that culture are different than the way things are done today. So it kind of helps to understand a little bit of how things were done, and let's see how they happen here. Well, in those days, as you know, and in fact, even today in that culture, people don't choose their own wives, their own spouses. They're chosen by the parents. The parents marry, and it's often for family reasons, for political reasons, for whatever reasons. Parents of the bride and the groom choose the bride and grooms, and they're arranged marriages. So did we have that happen here? Well, look back at 24 verses 3 to 4, remember? Abraham said, I want you to swear by Yahweh that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac. And don't take Isaac with you. So Isaac has no idea what he's getting. Okay, this is an arranged marriage just as was common in those times. What about in the next generation? Well, that's kind of interesting. The next generation, who are the sons in the next generation? Okay, Jacob and Esau. Well, did they follow the same path? Well, take a look at the end of chapter 26, verses 34 and 35. It says, when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Barai, the Hittite, and also Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Verse 35, they were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. So Esau did not follow the custom, and he picked his own wives, and they were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. On contrasted to that, if you look at the end of chapter 27 through 28, we see Rebekah says to Isaac, I'm disgusted with living because of these Hittite women. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living. So Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him and commanded him, do not marry a Canaanite woman. Go at once to Padan Aram, to the house of your mother's father, Bethuel. Take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Okay? So we see the next generation, one did and one didn't. The one that didn't created problems. The one that did recognized and stayed within the separate cut-off people that God had commanded Abraham and his descendants to be. So we have the arranged marriage here. All right. Also, you would have the father of the woman would give his daughter to the future husband. So did we have that here? Chapter 24, 50 to 51. Laban and Bethuel answered, well, this is from Yahweh. We can say nothing to you. Here's Rebekah. Take her and go. Let her be the wife of your master's son as the Lord has directed. So you see, Bethuel, the father, gave Rebekah, the woman, to Isaac. Okay, so follow that custom. Now, there would be a bride price, a purchase price that was paid to the bride's father. So do we have that here? Verse 53. Then the servant brought out gold and silver jewelry and articles of clothing and gave them to Rebekah. But he also gave costly gifts to her brother and to her mother. So, yes, we have the bride price here given to the family. Then you would have a dowry that the bride's father would give to the bride to give to his daughter. And it would be property. Well, in this case, property wouldn't do a whole lot of good because they're going off to another country. Or maybe maids or a maid or something like that. Some kind of something to help his daughter. Do we have that here? Well, verse 59 says, so they sent their sister Rebekah on her way along with her nurse and Abraham's servant and his men. So you see, he gave her a nurse. So you do have the dowry there. You would then have a time called the betrothal. When you remember the story of Mary and Joseph, they were betrothed. They were not married at the time. Betrothal is like being engaged, but it's a whole lot stronger. There is a betrothal ceremony. When you get betrothed, you go through a ceremony kind of similar to our marriage ceremonies today, and you're betrothed for a period of time, typically up to about a year, but it would be until the husband, until the groom, had things in order and was ready to take the woman into his home. And this betrothal was very serious. In fact, if you were betrothed, to break a betrothal, you had to get a divorce. Okay, so it's not like just breaking an engagement today. It was a serious matter. So, do we have a betrothal period here? Well, 54 to 58. Let's see. The servant and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night there. When they got up the next morning, he said, send me on my way to my master. Okay. But her brother and her mother replied, well, let the girl remain with us for 10 days or so, and then you can go. Why? Just a day ago, they didn't even know this guy. He shows up in the evening when the women go to draw water, and then he shows up for dinner, and early the next morning, he's wanting to take their daughter, their sister. You know, all of a sudden, Rebecca's here, and now she's gone. We want to say goodbye to her and help her get her affairs in order, and don't just let her go so quick. But the servant said to him, do not detain me. Now that Yahweh has granted success to my journey, send me on my way. Because he's got a month's travel, right, ahead of him. Send me on my way so I may go to my master. Well, then they said, well, let's call the girl and ask her about it. So they called Rebekah and asked her, will you go with this man? I will go, she said. So What was the betrothal here? Well, there wasn't a whole lot of betrothal. The servant was in a hurry, but obviously you've got, you know, she's basically engaged. She's going because she's getting married to this guy. And even though he's not there for this betrothal, you've got kind of a 30-day or a month-long as they travel period that would serve kind of as a betrothal. Now, there's a blessing when she leaves. Her family gives her a blessing. And look at that at verse 60. It says, they blessed Rebekah and said to her, our sister, may you increase to thousands upon thousands. May your offspring possess the gates of their enemies. What's in that blessing? The same stuff that's in the blessings that God promised to Abraham and to his descendants, to Isaac. So the blessings that that God promised to Isaac are the blessings that Rebekah's family is asking God to give her. So, and they didn't know. They didn't know that. Anything about God's covenant through Isaac. Okay, after the betrothal, once they were betrothed, after the betrothal, the bride would be brought to her husband's home, and that would be the official marriage. Okay, that would be the official, they would be fully married then. So how do we see that here? Going on, verse 61. Then Rebekah and her maids got ready and mounted their camels and went back with the man. So the servant took Rebekah and left. Now Isaac had come from Beer Lahai Roy. Beer, remember, is a well, and this is the well where Hagar and Ishmael were, if you remember the story back there. That's where he was hanging out at that time because he was living in the Negev. That's down in the Negev area. By this time, Ishmael was down in the Sinai area. He went out to the field one evening to meditate, and as he looked up, he saw camels approaching. Well, Rebekah also looked up and saw Isaac. She got down from her camel and asked the servant, who's that man in the field coming to meet us? Well, he's my master, the servant answered. So she took her veil and covered herself. Okay, so he still wasn't going to get to see her until they were fully married. So Rebekah, going on, then the servant told Isaac all that he had done, and Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah. So you see the right then, that day, he's married. Okay, he gets married. Now, in this process, because they didn't know each other first, because it was arranged through the whole process, people would marry first, and then love would come. Okay, then they would fall in love with each other. Do we have that here? Verse 67. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah, so she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Okay? So here, she became his wife, and then he loved her. So you have that same pattern. Okay? So that's the story of Isaac marrying Rebekah and how all that happened and moving on to the next generation. Now, chapter 25, we'll pick up on that next week. We'll skip that now, and let's go to chapter 26. And learn a little bit more about the story of Isaac. We see various times of famine in those days. And so a time of famine comes up. Isaac's married to Rebekah, and so we're moving on. Where did Isaac go during a time of famine? If there's a time of famine and you're living in the Negev, again, is not a very... It's a dry area. It's not quite desert, but it's not lush and green either. Not a great place to raise crops, and if there's a famine, you got to go somewhere where you can get food, where your sheep can eat, all that kind of stuff. So, where does he go, and what's a natural place? If you're in the southern part of Canaan, a natural place would be to go to Egypt, and why didn't he do that? Egypt has got lots of food. You got the Nile River there. We'll see that again in with Moses. Genesis 26. Now, there was a famine in the land. That's besides the earlier famine of Abraham's time. And Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines in Gerar. Yahweh had appeared to Isaac and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. So he didn't go to Egypt because God told him not to. So here we're seeing that God's speaking to Isaac. Isaac is following in the faith of his father Abraham. Abraham walked and talked with God. We're seeing that with the next generation with Isaac here. God tells him, don't go to Egypt, live in the land where I tell you to live. And so with a famine comes, instead of going to Egypt, he goes to the land of the Philistines, goes to Gerar over in the land of Philistia. What else did God say to Isaac, and why? Stay in this land for a while, he said, and I will be with you. I will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands and confirm the oath that I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and will give them all these lands. And through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed. Okay? So he promised all these promises that he had given to Abraham, the promises of blessings, of land, of descendants. He gives those promises to him. Why? Verse 5, because your father Abraham obeyed me and kept my commands, my decrees, and my laws. So he's being blessed because of the promises. He's being blessed with these promises because of the promises that God made to Abraham, because of the faith of Abraham. We'll see various times throughout the Bible, like the descendants of David. God blessed them because of David's faithfulness. So being associated with a faithful person rubs off. We see various times where these faithful patriarchs go to a land and are around other people, and the other people say, hey, stay with me. I prosper when you're around me because of your faithfulness. So question for us is, does our faith life bless other people, or are other people blessed by being associated with us because of our faithfulness? Now, here he went to another nation, Philistia, and if you remember, Abraham did too. There's a couple of times. He went to Egypt, and he went to the land of the Philistines, same basic area. What had Abraham done back then? He displayed a lack of trust in God protecting him, because at that time he said, Sarah, when we go down to Egypt, tell everybody you're my sister. It's not a full lie, but it's not a full truth either. So a half lie is a half, or a half truth is a half lie, and that's what he did. He said, just tell them you're my sister because you're beautiful, and I'm afraid that they'll kill me to try to get to you. So if you tell them that you're my sister, then they'll protect me, and they won't try to kill me, and they'll bless me on account of you, that kind of thing. Well, that's a challenge to God's plan. Well, what about Isaac? Now, he's in another land, going on, chapter verse 6. So Isaac stayed in Gerar. When the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, she's my sister, because he was afraid to say that she's my wife. He thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah because she's beautiful. So he made the same mistake, the same lack of trust that his father. His father had done it twice, two strikes. Well, now here's the third strike from his son. He doesn't learn from the lessons that his father had here. He does the same thing. Well, in those situations with Abraham, it always created problems for the others, for people who were around and were impacted by the lies of Abraham. What about here? Now let's go on. Verse 8, when Isaac had been there a long time, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked down from the window and saw Isaac caressing his wife Rebekah. Who? So Abimelech summoned Isaac and said, she's your wife. Why did you say that she's my sister? Isaac answered him, because I thought I might lose my life on account of her. And Abimelech said, well, what is this that you've done to us? One of the men might well have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech gave orders to all the people, anyone who molests this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Okay? So he was scolded by Abimelech, but then he was given protection. Why did Abimelech care? Well, obviously, it was very clear, and you'll see this, God's with this guy. And just as the other Abimelech earlier on with Abraham didn't want to get on the wrong side of Abraham, this Abimelech doesn't want to get on the wrong side of Isaac. How does God bless Isaac in Philistia? Going on. Isaac planted crops in that land, and the same year reaped a hundredfold because the Lord blessed him. The man became rich, and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy. Okay? So God made him very wealthy with crops, and we'll see as we go on with flocks and herds and servants. And this is even more so than Abraham, because Abraham gave all of his wealth to and turned over everything to Isaac. And so it just continues to grow. But this becomes a problem. Just as it was a problem in Abraham's time, we see that Isaac had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped him up, filling him with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, "Move away from us. You've become too powerful for us." So he had grown too wealthy, too large to become a welcome visitor in Philistia, so they they asked him to leave. Did Isaac take offense at Abimelech's request for him to leave? Going on, it says, Isaac moved away from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. Isaac reopened the wells that had been dug in the time of his father Abraham that the Philistines had stopped up after Abraham died. And he gave him the same names that his father had given him. So we don't see that he took offense. We don't see that he reacted. He just said, okay, and he moves on. Again, he's a stranger in a strange land. He doesn't have any property. He's a wanderer. And his ability to live in the land is a blessing from God and depends on the being able to live with the people who do own the property and do live there. Now this is kind of dry land, and so you see he reopened wells, but you still need more water with all these flocks that he's got and all these people that he's got. So how does water become a problem? Going on. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water there. Now, digging a well is a big thing. It takes a lot of manpower to dig because you're talking shovels and big holes, and it's not like getting one of these drilling machines on the back of a truck to drill a hole. So it took a lot of work to dig this well. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen and said, "Hey, the water's ours." So he named the well Esek because they disputed with him. Esek means dispute. Then they dug another well, but they quarreled over that one also. So he named it Sitna, because Sitna means opposition. He moved on from there and dug another well. Gave it a little time, and no one quarreled over it, so he named it Rehoboth, saying that Yahweh has given us room, and we will flourish in the land. Rehoboth means room. So he's now got room. He's got some space to live without stepping on anyone or getting in anyone's ways or having disagreements with anyone. Okay? So the Philistines kept disputing the water rights, but he finally found a place where he could stay. And then he moves on, we see, verse 23, from there he went up to Beersheba. That night the Lord appeared, Yahweh appeared to him and said, "I am God of your father Abraham. Don't be afraid, because I am with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." So Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of Yahweh. There he pitched his tent, and there his servants dug a well. Okay? So Isaac moved to Beersheba. God appears to him, restates his promises to him. And how does Isaac respond? Same way his dad did, is he worships God. Okay? Builds an altar, calls upon God, and worships God there. Okay? Now we see there in Beersheba, which is not right there at Philistia, the Philistine leaders over in Gerar, though, they come track him down. Why? Meanwhile, Abimelech had come to him from Gerar, while Ahuza, his personal advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his forces. Isaac asked him, "Why have you come to me since you were so hostile to me and sent me away?" So you see, he does remember that, and he was, although he understood it. They answered, "Well, we saw clearly that Yahweh was with you, so we said, there ought to be a sworn agreement between us and you. Let's make a treaty with you that you won't do us any harm, just as we did not molest you, but always treated you well, and we sent you away in peace. And now you're blessed by Yahweh." So they saw that God was with Isaac, and they wanted a treaty with him to protect him. If you remember back in Genesis 21, we had the same sort of thing, an oath between Abraham and the Abimelech at that time. And This place was called Beersheba. Beersheba means beer is well. Sheba means oath. So oath of the, well of the oath is what that means. So here we have another oath that's or treaty that's going into effect here. So does Isaac accept or refuse this request for a treaty? Isaac then made a feast for them, and they ate and drank. Early the next morning, the men swore an oath to each other. Then Isaac sent them on their way, and they left in peace. Okay, so he accepted what they requested, made an oath, just like his father had. It says, that day Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they dug. They said, hey, we found water. So he called it Sheba. Okay, Sheba means oath. And to this day, the name of the town has been called Beersheba, or well of the oath. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you've given us, the stories of the patriarchs, the men of faith. We see faithfulness. We see how you bless them. We see how they're real people, and they fall away. They don't trust you entirely, but yet you still are there for them, and you still call them back to you. We thank you for showing us stories where you guide people, and they recognize your guidance as the servant who went to find the wife for Isaac. Help us to see your guidance and recognize your guidance and recognize your will for our lives as we go through our day-to-day lives. Forgive us when we don't follow your path, when we don't recognize your guidance, when we stray from the directions that you want us to stray, want us to go. Work your spirit among us so that we can recognize the ways that you want us to go. We pray in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.